Thank you for joining us weekdays from noon to two. And we also welcome David Morata to the studio, who joins us each and every month on topics of interest, usually relating to money and finances. He's the president of Morata Wealth Management. And we're talking today about trickle-down economics and what it means to liberals and what it means to conservatives. Hey, David, welcome back to The Shilling Show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so this term, I seem to recall that I heard this first regarding Art Laffer back in the Reagan days, but was that the origination of the term?
That is. As Reagan was, the Reagan administration was pushing to lower tax rates on the very top income earners, his opponents started criticizing him with the idea of trickle-down economics, as though if you could just, you know, give money to the rich, then somehow that'll trickle down to everyone else. And that term has stuck today. It's been a common criticism. I suppose if it stops working, the left will stop using it, but that's the common criticism of any kind of tax cuts for the rich.
So this is interesting because it's obviously pejorative. It was meant to make fun of all of this. But if you think about it, water doesn't trickle up. You know, when something falls with gravity, it naturally percolates in a downward fashion. So if people thought that the opposite was true, that, hey, let's just give $1 million to every poor person in Charlottesville and see what happens, the results may not be so good. And so I think there's a lot to consider in the topic. This is never used as a term other than being malicious, is it?
No. In fact, the entire idea that they're criticizing is purported by no conservative economist. In fact, no economist in his right mind would ever think that if you give lots of money to person A, somehow that will benefit person B. If you just stop and think about it on the raw, what are they saying that conservatives believe? They're saying conservatives believe that if you give a lot of money to the rich, it will benefit the poor. If we want to benefit the poor, just give money directly to them. And maybe that's why they're making the case, is because that's what they think. They think if you give lots of money to the poor, it will benefit society as a whole. And what they don't realize is that for government to give money away, it first has to take it from someone.
So this I think is a very critical point, David, is that they talk the cost of tax cuts and all that as if the money belongs to the government in the first place. And so if we're talking about letting somebody, whether they're rich or poor, keep their own money, that's not giving them money at all, is it?
Yeah, it's interesting. They're even talking about how the new proposal for the new healthcare proposal will save the government, and that it's some tiny amount. It's some, you know, $300 billion or something like that. What they're not really reporting in that is that it will save the government actually closer to $1.4 trillion, but it will also be accompanied with tax cuts of $1.1 trillion. And so the tiny amount that it's going to save the government sounds small, but the amount it's going to save the American people in terms of the excess taxation that it's going to remove is tremendous. And so because we're not giving lots of money away, we're also can leave that money back in the economy, and hopefully it will be tax cuts for the incentives in the right place for tax cuts to happen.
So this is a little off track from what we're talking about, but I do think it's important and it's tangentially related in what we were talking about before the segment started. So when the Trump administration and Tom Price and others say, I don't trust the CBO analysis, or it's not correct because it's not taking other things into consideration, other components, is one of those, it sounds like, is what you just mentioned.
I think that's from the CBO, but the way the media is reporting it makes it sound like it's a tiny little amount that it will close the deficit, when in fact it's a huge amount that it will return to the American people. And it's those kinds of characterizations, I think, that show the media's liberal bias.
On the theme here, and we've got about a minute and a half to do this, and then we'll come back on the other side. Ken the Democrat writes in, how about giving the poor the opportunity to buy relatively inexpensive health care? Is that not a direct benefit to them? Does a person who works 40, 50, or 60 hours not deserve to either make a wage that allows her to buy insurance or receive help from the more fortunate of us to buy it?
Yeah, it's, you know, every time you start talking about you know, shouldn't the poor have health care and shouldn't the poor have, you know, various things? And you're trying to give them that benefit first. What you do is you take away the poor's choice to get cash.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you start talking about a lot of the benefits to the poor as, look, let's just give them a pile of cash and let them decide what to do with it, then a lot of these issues go away. Why should we provide free health care when we don't provide free water? Water is much more essential to life. Mm-hmm. You will die without water in a matter of days. So why don't we provide free water? Why are we making the poor person have to decide between eating and water?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just give them free water? In fact, why don't we just give them free food? You can make that argument for all of the necessities of life. It turns out health insurance is not one of the necessities of life. It is not. I'm sure I'll be much maligned for that comment, but not having health insurance is not the worst thing in the world. And that's why with the choice, many people are going to decide that the health insurance that is offered on the market today is just not worth it. It's not worth paying thousands of dollars when you don't use any of the benefit and you're young and you're healthy and you don't need insurance. Why do people think they need insurance? They need insurance to subsidize us old people, us old aging baby boomers. We want them to be throwing lots of money in to keep our premiums low. And that's really not a fair thing to do.
977-1070. We return with David Marotta on the other side. What does trickle-down economics mean to liberals and conservatives? Stay with us. The Shilling Show continues here. It's a Tuesday edition of the program. Thanks for joining us weekdays from noon to 2. And we continue with David Marotta talking today about trickle-down economics. What does it mean to liberals and conservatives? So I want to go to the proponents of lower tax rates and what their motivations are, because this is interesting and I think it's often misconstrued.
Yeah, if you tax profits at lower tax rates, the benefits of that productivity will be greater, and it'll be greater after tax, mm-hmm. and there'll be more productivity. So it's really trying to make the incentives all in the right place. So just as an example, pretend like we have a very successful business owner, and they're in the near 50% tax rate. That's so that everything they have to pay is 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And now pretend like we have someone else who is in much lower tax rate. Their incentives for starting a business are very different because they both have to start a business. They both have to put a lot of capital into it. They both have to risk a great deal of capital. And one of them is going to have basically half of the return on investment that the other one is going to have. And for every business decision is made at the margin of what the return on his investment is going to be given their current tax rate. So there's a lot of people who won't take the risk. They'll just simply put it in the stock market where it's less risky because you're not starting your own business. And starting your own business is, it's kind of backward to the way most people think it is. Most people think is if you give money to the rich, well, then they're richer, and then they spend their money, and then if there's anything left over, things trickle mm-hmm. down. Most business adventures go the exact opposite. It's only after money invested in a new business is first paid out to employers and suppliers and contractors and everyone else. Now, if there's anything left over, that's what the business person who's taking the risk gets. And if there's going to be very little left over because whatever is left over is going to get cut in half by taxes, then there's very little incentive to take all of those risks. And believe me, businesses are very risky. They mm-hmm. first they take a lot of work, and then a lot of them do end up going bankrupt. So just to take that risk requires the incentives to want to do that.
Yeah, so we see that. And then we see government, and let's just talk about Albemarle County. And we see these disincentives for people to even start a business. You mentioned the risk that you take. But just having to deal with the government itself and the preposterous taxation schemes, the shakedown, they want to tax you on your pens and they want to tax you on your chairs and your paper clips and your computers. They really get in there. I have somebody who is being hounded by the county right now, a friend of a listener to this program, who was in business as a masseuse and working for somebody else. And they continue to hound her and want to tax the table that she uses. I mean, you talk about disincentives and you talk about people just saying, I'm just not even going to step into this whole thing because it's such a mess.
Yeah, here we are. We're on March 14th.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out business tax returns for the federal government are not due until March 15th. They're actually due tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
However, on March 1st, Albemarle County requires you to report everything that's on the business tax return. So 2 weeks before my tax preparer is going to have everything ready, I have to report that number to Albemarle County so that they can tax me. And in past years, they had a lot of business owners, like myself,
mm-hmm.
who would end up turning that in late because we don't have it. Our accountant is still going over all of the stuff. And I don't know if you know about accountants, but they're sometimes filing extended returns and things mm-hmm. like that because they actually don't have the numbers. But for the business returns, they're due on March 15th. I often will get them a few days early because they're trying to make sure that everything is correct.
Mm-hmm.
So because they don't get them on time, they decided this year we'll just add penalties because it can't be the fact that we've set our date too early. We're just going to add penalties that if you don't file on time, then you owe an extra, whatever, 10% or something like that because you're not giving it to us on time. Everything is all about government running smoothly, and nothing is about the business owners actually having a conducive environment to do their business.
And, you know, you bring up these penalties. I think they're usurious in many ways. You know, they try to clamp down on the short-term lenders and the pawn shops and the title loans, you know, which are providing services that people need, but saying, hey, you're charging too much money. And yet you look at what they charge people for interest and penalties on very small amounts. They're incredibly usurious. It kind of goes back to the conversation earlier about people in government needing to live up to their own rules.
It's true. I have one business. Every year it makes less than $100,000. It's a very small business. So I sent in the form with the $50 that I owe because it doesn't make that much money. $50 mm-hmm. is the minimum. And I sent in my check. They returned the entire thing to me because I didn't have the exact number of how much I had made, even though I knew it was going to be under $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what to do if you don't yet have your taxes back from your accountant and you're supposed to file it with the county and you can't just pay more than you need because you have to have the exact number down there. And then later on, I'll let them write me a check for the amount that they owe me back. None of that makes any sense. And no one at the county seems to care one whit about actually trying to help businesses do what they need to do to comply with their rules because their rules are so onerous. And again, to have a tax on gross receipts, some businesses are working on margins that are incredibly small.
Mm-hmm.
And so since the tax is not on profits, it's on gross receipts, it becomes even more onerous because it could make the difference between being profitable and actually having a loss because you have to pay your taxes.
Right, and others are losing money. They're making gross receipts, but businesses lose money and they're paying tax on a profit that's not realized.
Yeah, if you have a startup that hasn't yet found a profit yet, your negative red ink is mm-hmm. made worse by the county taxing you on it.
It's absolutely outrageous. When we come back on the other side of the break for our final segment with David Murata, I do want to talk about things that you could cut back on in government that would benefit the poor. And also lowering the capital gains tax, which has been a proposal that's being kicked around right now on the federal level and even looking at lowering some corporate taxes, what that actually would do. Stay with us. 977-1070. The Shilling Show continues with David Murata right after this. The Shilling Show continues here. Our final segment of this hour, David Murata is our guest. We're talking about trickle-down economics, what it means to liberals and conservatives, and policies that actually would be helpful instead of harmful. And on the topic of the last segment of business taxes, Scotty writes in and says, and now you see why people like us cannot wait to get out of Albemarle County. And I know Scotty, and Scotty is planning to get out of here and go somewhere else that's less oppressive in the near future. And it's sad because a lot of people feel like that. I mean, I've got to tell you, I've had the conversation with my wife, David, and you know us, and I would hate to feel like I had to leave this place because I came here affirmatively to flee California. But at some point, it gets to be onerous to live in a place. You feel oppressed. You feel like you don't have any representation or anyone that even cares about your concerns on the government level. And you say, well, what are my options? Stay here and dislike it or relocate.
Yeah, and it's actually a political technique to tax, to put into effect laws and regulations and taxes that hurt your opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Democratic areas are Democratic because they put in onerous taxes upon business owners and drove a lot of the conservatives out of the area. It's why a lot of inner cities have fallen apart,
mm-hmm.
And it's happening a little bit here in Virginia. And I'm with you. I've known a number of business owners who've either moved just outside of Albemarle County or have decided to move out of Virginia entirely,
mm-hmm.
Because of the some of the policies that are a little bit more onerous here. North Carolina is a little bit better, and mm-hmm. a lot of them can just slip over the border into North Carolina,
right.
or just slip right out of Albemarle County. I know that if my wife and I slipped out of Albemarle County, I would immediately get $12,000 more on various taxes in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems a ridiculous thing to be able to get $12,000 more just for locating my business out of Albemarle County.
You mean $12,000 less that you'd have to pay?
Yeah, $12,000 less that I'd have to pay
in
taxes because we're here in the county.
Yeah, it's very sad. So let's talk about some affirmative things that could be done. And one of them, it has to do with this professional occupancy licensing, which in some places is completely out of control. If you want to put up wallpaper or it's crazy. So what's wrong with the system that we have right now?
Yeah, so just like if you have to have a medallion to drive a taxi cab, taxi cabs will cost a lot of money. And if you can get Uber, it will cost a fraction of the cost and be better service and be all around better off.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, that's true of a lot of different disciplines. Why should you have to have a medallion to drive a taxi cab?
You should.
That kind of licensing doesn't make any sense. Similarly, licensing, for example, for hair care, any kind of hair care, you have to have a license for it. And the license has to include being able to know how to handle chemicals for all of the different dyeing and things like that goes on in hair care. So if you try to open a store and you have no dyeing, all you do is hair braiding, for example, you still need to have the license.
The same license.
The same license. And you have to have gone to 3 years of cosmetic school or whatever and be licensed. It doesn't make any sense. And in a free economy, you don't try to restrict what people do. I'm of the opinion that all of that regulation costs more than it's worth. I am of much more of the laissez-faire point of view because I've looked at a lot of the regulations and I realized that regulations don't actually make us safer. My favorite example is these Sarbanes-Oxley laws that mm-hmm. were put into effect after Enron. They were trying to protect us from Enron, and what they do is they cost American companies 4 Enrons every single year.
Wow.
So in trying to protect us from one Enron that has happened in the past, it's costing us 4 every single year. Similarly, a lot of the banking arrangements in Dodd-Frank mm-hmm. are incredibly onerous and have caused a lot of problems. And it's the reason why you can't get cheaper banking actually here. The banks outside the United States cannot become part of our banking system. You can't bank with a foreign banker. Because if they start taking American clients, then they have to abide by the Dodd-Frank rules that basically allow the American government to come in and dismantle their bank anytime they want. And so it's very, very difficult for foreign banks to be able to comply with all of the American rules. And why also American banks can't compete outside the United States very well, because all of this compliance costs them money, and they're not as low cost an option when it goes to global banking. So all of the banks that the rest of the world banks with are in Hong Kong and Singapore and Europe because they have different banking rules, and it costs a lot less.
So they must be having massive fraud. The bankers and the big businesses must be raiding the accounts and stealing money from all those people, because what we're told here is, hey, the reason that we have all the problems is because we don't have enough regulation.
Yeah. And my sort of favorite regulation is people always point to, we're out at a restaurant and they always point to their food and say, I am so glad we have regulations because now I know that what I'm eating is okay. And I've seen the health, code, the health visits that are part of the regulations.
Yeah.
They happen twice a year. And so for other than twice a year, nothing is being regulated. And why would the restaurant serve you a pile of garbage anyway?
Mm-hmm.
They have their standards and their reputation. And their standards and reputation are worth a lot more to them than any kind of compliance with all of the rules. And I've just sort of learned any kind of products. If you want to put out some kind of a product, and you have a 2 ounce container and a 1 ounce container and a 1/2 ounce container, you have to keep a set of those for 2 years after the expiration date, and you have to keep all three sets. So if you're just making a mint tea blend or something mm-hmm. like that, and you get mint from a farmer, you have to have it tested to make sure it's really mint. You can't just take the farmer's word for he's certifying that it's mint. Mm-hmm. You have to test it again to make sure, yes, it is mint. All of that regulation makes things incredibly expensive, and it adds to us, to the economic waste in 1,000 different ways. And I don't think people realize how onerous the burden of regulations is in the United States, because most people are not the entrepreneurs and they're not the business owners, and they don't realize that so much of your time is spent with something that does nothing for the consumer. It just complies with government regulations.
And it creates a lot of jobs for bureaucrats, which is why I'm so delighted that if we look up at the Trump administration saying, hey, I want to cut 20% at the federal level. I mean, this is something that the libertarians say 50%, which I'd be happy to do. But that's a huge number. If somebody goes up there and starts dismantling this administrative state, even at 5%, you would hear screaming and moaning. But it would be great for the country.
It is, and it makes a great sense. For those of you who haven't worked in government, government is incredibly wasteful. One summer intern from college is often doing more work than the entire department they're working in. Because the department has they have their own incentives, mm-hmm. and their incentives are to keep their funding up high. And to keep their funding up high, they often have to look a lot busier than they are. And all of those incentives make an incredible waste within government, because all the incentives in government are in the wrong direction. No company wants to have more people employed doing less work, but government can do that because they're not competing in the open economy. And so the less government we have and the more private enterprise we have, the more efficient economy we have.
Yeah, in fact, the government has this perverse incentive to do exactly the opposite, because the bigger they are and the more people they hire, and we've seen it here in the city of Charlottesville, Albemarle County, adding all of these positions, it gives them more power, more taxation, and diminishes the individual freedom that the residents have. So the government, that is what they want to do, by and large.
Yeah, and no one really complains about big government. At least with big pharma, you cannot buy their products.
Mm-hmm.
At least with, big whatever, big oil, you cannot buy their products. You have a choice. Big government is, by its very nature, you're unable to have a choice. You're unable to avoid it. You have to comply at the point of a gun. And I think that's another way to see a lot of these regulations is, if you don't keep your 2 ounce and your 1 ounce and your 1/2 ounce bottle for 2 years after the expiration date, we're going to shoot you in the head. and I think you need to understand that all of government is done with the threat of force. And we really shouldn't have that kind of threat of force over such trivial matters as paperwork.
We certainly shouldn't. We've got about a minute to wrap this up. Where do we go from here, and do we ever reconcile these various viewpoints of economics in America?
Well, I think the evidence is clear if people are willing to look at it with an open mind. When Reagan reduced the top rate, the top income tax rate from 70%, finally all the way down to 28%, you had much fuller employment. You had the boom of the 80s. Mm-hmm. You collected more tax revenue, oddly enough. Now, people say our deficits increased. Yes, they did. We had a Democratic Congress, and unfortunately, government eats a roaring economy because they just keep increasing themselves bigger and faster than the economy does. The other thing is that the more burden that you put upon the rich in terms of the tax code, it's actually the more variable you make tax revenues. Because the rich take risks, and when they take risks, their income fluctuates a great deal. And because it fluctuates a great deal, you can have a year in which the income is down. If you really wanted to have a stable government, you would have everyone pay the same amount. You take whatever you want to spend, divide by the number of people. Mm-hmm. That would be stable, and that would be fair. So what we have now is the top 20% of all income taxpayers pay virtually all of the income tax. And the bottom 50% actually get a lot of benefits from that in terms of negative income taxes.
Yeah, we've got a lot of problems to solve. David Morata, Great conversation. He's online at MuradaOnMoney.com. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. All right, we'll have open phones on the other side. 977-1070. You can get in line right now. Shilling Show returns.